And what? Rachel said.
Speak English.
Monocelled plankton capable of oxidizing a luminescent catalyst called luciferin.
That was English?
Tolland exhaled and turned to his friend. Corky, there any chance the meteorite we pulled out of that hole had living organisms on it? Corky burst out laughing.
Mike, be serious.
I am serious.
No chance, Mike, believe me. If NASA had any inkling whatsoever that there were extraterrestrial organisms living on that rock, you can be damn sure they never would have extracted it into the open air.
Tolan looked only partially comforted, his relief apparently clouded by a deeper mystery. I can't be for sure without a microscope, Tolan said. But it looks to me like this is a bioluminescent plankton from the phylum Periphyta. Its name means fire plant. The Arctic Ocean is filled with it. Corky shrugged.
So, why'd you ask if they were from space?
Because, Tolan said, the meteorite was buried in glacial ice. Fresh water from snowfalls. The water in that hole is glacial melt and has been frozen for 3 centuries. How could ocean creatures get in there? Tolan's point brought a long silence. Rachel stood at the edge of the pool and tried to get her mind around what she was looking at. Bioluminescent plankton in the extraction shaft. What does it mean? There's got to be a crack somewhere down there, Tolan said. It's the only explanation. The plankton must have entered the shaft through a fissure in the ice that allowed ocean water to seep in. Rachel didn't understand.
Seep in? From where?
She recalled her long ice rover ride in from the ocean. The coast is a good 2 miles from here. Both Corky and Tolan gave Rachel an odd look.
Actually, Corky said, the ocean is directly underneath us. This slab of ice is floating.
Rachel stared at the two men, feeling utterly perplexed.
Floating? But we're on a glacier.
Yes, we're on a glacier, Tolan said. But we're not over land. Glaciers sometimes flow off a landmass and fan out over water. Because ice is lighter than water, the glacier simply continues to flow, floating out over the ocean like an enormous ice raft. That's the definition of an ice shelf, the floating section of a glacier. He paused. We're actually almost a mile out to sea at the moment. Shocked, Rachel instantly became wary. As she adjusted her mental picture of her surroundings, the thought of standing over the Arctic Ocean brought with it a sense of fear. Tolan seemed to sense her uneasiness. He stamped his foot reassuringly on the ice. Don't worry. This ice is 300 feet thick, with 200 of those feet floating below the water like an ice cube in a glass. Makes the shelf very stable. You could build a skyscraper on this thing. Rachel gave a wan nod, not entirely convinced. The misgivings aside, she now understood Tolan's theory about the origins of the plankton.
He thinks there's a crack that goes all the way down to the ocean, allowing plankton to come up through it into the hole. It was feasible, Rachel decided, and yet it involved a paradox that bothered her.
Nora Manger had been very clear about the integrity of the glacier, having drilled dozens of test cores to confirm its solidity. Rachel looked at Tolland.
I thought the glacier's perfection was the cornerstone of all the strata dating records. Didn't Dr. Manger say the glacier had no cracks or fissures?
Corky frowned.
Looks like the Ice Queen muffed it.
Don't say that too loudly, Rachel thought, or you'll get an ice pick in the back. Tolan stroked his chin as he watched the phosphorescing creatures.
There's literally no other explanation. There must be a crack. The weight of the ice shelf on top of the ocean must be pushing plankton-rich seawater up into the hole.
One hell of a crack, Rachel thought. If the ice here was 300 feet thick and the hole was 200 feet deep, then this hypothetical crack had to pass through 100 feet of solid ice. Nora Manger's test cores showed no cracks.
Do me a favor, Tolan said to Corky. Go find Nora.
Let's hope to God she knows something about this glacier that she's not telling us. And find Ming, too. Maybe he can tell us what these little glow beasties are. Corky headed off.
Better hurry, Tallon called after him, glancing back into the hole. I could swear this bioluminescence is fading. Rachel looked at the hole. Sure enough, the green was not so brilliant now. Tallon removed his parka and lay down on the ice next to the hole. Rachel watched, confused. Mike? I want to find out if there's any salt water flowing in. By lying on the ice without a coat? Yep. Tallon crawled on his belly to the edge of the hole. Holding one sleeve of the coat over the edge, he let the other sleeve dangle down the shaft until the cuff skimmed the water. This is a highly accurate salinity test used by world-class oceanographers. It's called licking a wet jacket. Out on the ice shelf, Delta One struggled with the controls, trying to keep the damaged microbot in flight over the group now assembled around the excavation pit. From the sounds of the conversation beneath, he knew things were unraveling fast. "Call the controller," he said. "We've got a serious problem." Chapter 40. Gabrielle Ashe had taken the White House public tour many times in her youth, secretly dreaming of someday working inside the presidential mansion and becoming part of the elite team that charted the country's future. At the moment, however, she would have preferred to be anywhere else in the world. As the Secret Service man from the East Gate led Gabrielle into an ornate foyer, she wondered what in the world her anonymous informant was trying to prove. Inviting Gabrielle into the White House was insane. What if I'm seen? Gabrielle had become quite visible lately in the media as Senator Sexton's right-hand aide. Certainly someone would recognize her. Miss Ashe? Gabrielle looked up. A kind-faced sentry in the foyer gave her a welcoming smile. Look over there, please, he pointed. Gabrielle looked to where he was pointing and was blinded by a flashbulb. Thank you, ma'am. The sentry led her to a desk and handed her a pen. Please sign the entry log. He pushed a heavy leather binder in front of her. Gabrielle looked at the log. The page before her was blank. She recalled hearing once that all White House visitors sign on their own blank page to preserve the privacy of their visit. She signed her name. So much for a secret meeting. Gabrielle walked through a metal detector and was then given a cursory pat-down. The sentry smiled. Enjoy your visit, Miss Ashe. Gabrielle followed the Secret Serviceman 50 feet down a tiled hallway to his second security desk. Here, another sentry was assembling a guest pass that was just rolling out of a lamination machine. He punched a hole in it, affixed a neck cord, and slipped it over Gabrielle's head. The plastic was still warm. The photo on the ID was the snapshot they had taken 15 seconds earlier down the hall. Gabrielle was impressed. Who says government is inefficient? They continued, the Secret Service man leading her deeper into the White House complex. Gabrielle was feeling more uneasy with every step. Whoever had extended the mysterious invitation certainly wasn't concerned about keeping the meeting private. Gabrielle had been issued an official pass, signed the guest log, and was now being marched in plain view through the first floor of the White House, where public tours were gathered. "And this is the China Room," a tour guide was saying to a group of tourists. "Home of Nancy Reagan's $952 per setting red-rimmed china that sparked a debate over conspicuous consumption back in 1981. The Secret Serviceman led Gabrielle past the tour toward a huge marble staircase where another tour was ascending. "You are about to enter the 3,200-square-foot East Room," the guide was narrating, "where Abigail Adams once hung John Adams' laundry. Then we'll pass to the Red Room, where Dolly Madison liquored up visiting heads of state before James Madison negotiated with them." The tourists laughed. Gabrielle followed past the stairway through a series of ropes and barricades into a more private section of the building. Here they entered a room Gabrielle had only seen in books and on television. Her breath grew short. My God, this is the map room. No tour ever came in here. The room's paneled walls could swing outward to reveal layer upon layer of world maps. This was the place where Roosevelt had charted the course of World War II. Unsettlingly, it was also the room from which Clinton had admitted his affair with Monica Lewinsky. Gabrielle pushed that particular thought from her mind. Most important, the map room was a passageway into the West Wing, the area inside the White House where the true power brokers worked. This was the last place Gabrielle Ashe had expected to be going. She had imagined her email was coming from some enterprising young intern or secretary working in one of the complex's more mundane offices. Apparently not. I'm going into the West Wing. The Secret Service man marched her to the very end of a carpeted hallway and stopped at an unmarked door. He knocked. Gabrielle's heart was pounding. "It's open," someone called from the inside. The man opened the door and motioned for Gabrielle to enter. Gabrielle stepped in. The shades were down and the room was dim. She could see the faint outline of a person sitting at a desk in the darkness. "Miss Ashe," the voice came from behind a cloud of cigarette smoke. "Welcome." As Gabrielle's eyes accustomed to the dark, she began to make out an unsettlingly familiar face, and her muscles went taut with surprise. "This is who has been sending me email?"
"Thank you for coming," Marjorie Tench said, her voice cold.
"Miss Tench?" Gabrielle stammered, suddenly unable to breathe.
"Call me Marjorie."
The hideous woman stood up, blowing smoke out of her nose like a dragon.
"You and I are about to become best friends."
Chapter 41. Nora Manger stood at the extraction shaft beside Tolland, Rachel, and Corky and stared into the pitch-black meteorite hole.
"Mike," she said, "you're cute, but you're insane. There is no bioluminescence here."
Tolland now wished he'd thought to take some video. While Corky had gone to find Nora and Ming, the bioluminescence had begun fading rapidly. Within a couple of minutes, all the twinkling had simply stopped. Tolland threw another piece of ice into the water, but nothing happened. No green splash.
"Where do they go?"
Corky asked. Tolland had a fairly good idea. Bioluminescence, one of nature's most ingenious defense mechanisms, was a natural response for plankton in distress. A plankton sensing it was about to be consumed by larger organisms would begin flashing in hopes of attracting much larger predators that would scare off the original attackers. In this case, the plankton, having entered the shaft through a crack, suddenly found themselves in a primarily freshwater environment and bioluminesced in panic as the freshwater slowly killed them.
"I think they died."
"They were murdered," Nora scoffed. "The Easter Bunny swam in and ate them."
Corky glared at her.
"I saw the luminescence too, Nora."
"Was it before or after you took LSD?"
"Why would we lie about this?"
Corky demanded.
"Men lie."
"Yeah, about sleeping with other women, but never about bioluminescent plankton."
Tolland sighed. "Nora, certainly you're aware that plankton do live in the oceans beneath the ice."
"Mike," she replied with a glare, "please don't tell me my business. For the record, there are over 200 species of diatoms that thrive under Arctic ice shelves. 14 species of autotrophic nanoflagellates, 20 heterotrophic flagellates, 40 heterotrophic dinoflagellates, and several metazoans, including polychaetes, amphipods, copepods, euphausids, and fish. Any questions?"
Tolland frowned. "Clearly you know more about Arctic fauna than I do. And you agree there's plenty of life underneath us. So why are you so skeptical that we saw bioluminescent plankton?"
"Because, Mike, this shaft is sealed. It's a closed, freshwater environment. No ocean plankton could possibly get in here."
"I tasted salt in the water," Tolland insisted. "Very faint, but present. Salt water is getting in here somehow."
"Right," Nora said skeptically. "You tasted salt. You licked the sleeve of an old sweaty parka, and now you've decided that the pod's density scans and 15 separate core samples are inaccurate."
Tallon held out the wet sleeve of his parka as proof.
Mike, I'm not licking your damn jacket.
She looked into the hole.
Might I ask why droves of alleged plankton decided to swim into this alleged crack?
Heat? Tallon ventured. A lot of sea creatures are attracted by heat. When we extracted the meteorite, we heated it. The plankton may have been drawn instinctively toward the temporarily warmer environment in the shaft.
Corky nodded. Sounds logical.
Logical.
Nora rolled her eyes. You know, for a prize-winning physicist and a world-famous oceanographer, you're a couple of pretty dense specimens. Has it occurred to you that even if there is a crack, which I assure you there is not, it is physically impossible for any seawater to be flowing into this shaft?
She stared at both of them with pathetic disdain.
But, Nora, Corky began. Gentlemen, we're standing above sea level here.
She stamped her foot on the ice.
Hello? This ice sheet rises 100 feet above the sea. You might recall the big cliff at the end of the shelf. We're higher than the ocean. If there were a fissure into this shaft, the water would be flowing out of this shaft, not into it. It's called gravity.
Tallon and Corky looked at each other.
Shit, Corky said. I didn't think of that.
Nora pointed into the water-filled shaft.
You may also have noticed that the water level isn't changing.
Tallon felt like an idiot. Nora was absolutely right. If there had been a crack, the water would be flowing out, not in. Tallon stood in silence a long moment, wondering what to do next.
Okay, Tallon sighed. Apparently the fissure theory makes no sense. But we saw bioluminescence in the water. The only conclusion is that it's not a closed environment after all. I realize much of your ice dating data is built on the premise that the glacier is a solid block, but...
Premise? Nora was obviously getting agitated.
Remember, this was not just my data, Mike. NASA made the same findings. We all confirmed this glacier is solid. No cracks.
Tallon glanced across the dome toward the crowd gathered around the press conference area.
Whatever is going on, I think, in good faith, we need to inform the administrator and... This is bullshit, Nora hissed. I'm telling you, this glacial matrix is pristine. I am not about to have my core data questioned by a salt lick and some absurd hallucinations.
She stormed over to a nearby supply area and began collecting some tools.
I'll take a proper water sample and show you this water contains no saltwater plankton, living or dead.
Rachel and the others looked on as Nora used a sterile pipette on a string to harvest a water sample from the melt pool. Nora placed several drops in a tiny device that resembled a miniature telescope. Then she peered through the oculus, pointing the device toward the light emanating from the other side of the dome. Within seconds, she was cursing.
Jesus Christ!
Nora shook the device and looked again.
Damn it! Something's got to be wrong with this refractometer. Salt water?
Corky gloated. Nora frowned.
Partial. It's registering 3% brine, which is totally impossible. This glacier is a snowpack. Pure fresh water. There should be no salt.
Nora carried the sample to a nearby microscope and examined it. She groaned.
Plankton?
Tallon asked.
G. polyhedra,
she replied, her voice now sedate. It's one of the planktons we glaciologists commonly see in the oceans under ice shelves. She glanced over at Tallon.
They're dead now.
Obviously they didn't survive long in a 3% saltwater environment. The four of them stood in silence a moment beside the deep shaft. Rachel wondered what the ramifications of this paradox were for the overall discovery. The dilemma appeared minor when compared to the overall scope of the meteorite, and yet, as an intel analyst, Rachel had witnessed the collapse of entire theories based on smaller snags than this.
What's going on over here?
The voice was a low rumble. Everyone looked up. The bearish frame of the NASA administrator emerged from the dark.
"Minor quandary with the water in the shaft," Tallon said. "We tried to sort it out."
Corky sounded almost gleeful.
"Nora's ice data is screwed."
"Bite me twice," Nora whispered.
The administrator approached, his furry eyebrows lowering.
"What's wrong with the ice data?"
Tallon heaved an uncertain sigh.
"We're showing a 3% saltwater mix in the meteorite shaft, which contradicts the glaciology report that the meteorite was encased in a pristine freshwater glacier."
He paused.
"There's also plankton present."
Ekstrom looked almost angry.
"Obviously that's impossible. There are no fissures in this glacier. The pod scans confirm that. This meteorite was sealed in a solid matrix of ice."
Rachel knew Ekstrom was correct. According to NASA's density scans, the ice sheet was rock solid. Hundreds of feet of frozen glacier on all sides of the meteorite. No cracks. And yet as Rachel imagined how density scans were taken, a strange thought occurred to her.
"In addition," Ekstrom was saying, "Dr. Manger's core samples confirm the solidity of the glacier."
"Exactly," Nora said, tossing the refractometer on a desk.
"Double corroboration. No fault lines in the ice, which leaves us no explanation whatsoever for the salt and plankton."
"Actually," Rachel said, the boldness of her voice surprising even herself, "there is another possibility."
The brainstorm had hit her from the most unlikely of memories. Everyone was looking at her now, their skepticism obvious. Rachel smiled.
"There's a perfectly sound rationale for the presence of salt and plankton."
She gave Tallon a wry look.
"And frankly, Mike, I'm surprised it didn't occur to you."
Chapter 42
"Plankton? Frozen in the glacier?"
Corky Marlinson sounded not at all sold on Rachel's explanation.
"Not to rain on your parade, but usually when things freeze, they die. These little buggers were flashing us, remember?"
"Actually," Tallon said, giving Rachel an impressed look, "she may have a point. There are a number of species that enter suspended animation when their environment requires it. I did an episode on that phenomenon once." Rachel nodded.
"You showed northern pike that got frozen in lakes and had to wait until the thaw to swim away. You also talked about microorganisms called water bears that became totally dehydrated in the desert, remained that way for decades, and then reinflated when rains returned."
Tallon chuckled.
"So you really do watch my show?"
Rachel gave a slightly embarrassed shrug.
"What's your point, Miss Sexton?"
Nora demanded.
"Her point," Tallon said, "which should have dawned on me earlier, is that one of the species I mentioned on that program was a kind of plankton that gets frozen in the polar ice cap every winter, hibernates inside the ice, and then swims away every summer when the ice cap thins."
Tallon paused.
"Granted, the species I featured on the show was not the bioluminescent species we saw here, but maybe the same thing happened."
"Frozen plankton,"
Rachel continued, excited to have Michael Tallon so enthusiastic about her idea,
"could explain everything we're seeing here. At some point in the past, fissures could have opened in this glacier, filled with plankton-rich saltwater, and then refroze. What if there were frozen pockets of saltwater in this glacier? Frozen saltwater containing frozen plankton. Imagine if while you were raising the heated meteorite through the ice, it passed through a frozen saltwater pocket. The saltwater ice would have melted, releasing the plankton from hibernation and giving us a small percentage of salt mixed in the freshwater."
"Oh, for the love of God," Nora exclaimed with a hostile groan. "Suddenly everyone's a glaciologist."
Corky also looked skeptical.
"But wouldn't Pods have spotted any brine ice pockets when it did its density scans? After all, brine ice and freshwater ice have different densities."
"Barely different," Rachel said.
4% is a substantial difference," Nora challenged.
"Yes, in a lab," Rachel replied. "But Pods takes its measurements from 120 miles up in space. Its computers were designed to differentiate between the obvious, ice and slush, granite and limestone. She turned to the administrator. Am I right to assume that when PODS measures densities from space, it probably lacks the resolution to distinguish brine ice from fresh ice? The administrator nodded.
Correct. A 4% differential is below PODS' tolerance threshold. The satellite would see brine ice and fresh ice as identical.
Tallon now looked intrigued.
This would also explain the static water level in the shaft.
He looked at Nora.
You said the plankton species you saw in the extraction shaft was called
G. polyhedra, Nora declared. And now you're wondering if G. polyhedra is capable of hibernating inside the ice. You'll be pleased to know the answer is yes. Absolutely. G. polyhedra is found in droves around ice shelves. It bioluminesces, and it can hibernate inside the ice. Any other questions?
Everyone exchanged looks. From Nora's tone, there was obviously some sort of but, and yet it seemed she had just confirmed Rachel's theory.
So, Tallon ventured, you're saying it's possible, right? This theory makes sense.
Sure, Nora said. If you're totally retarded.
Rachel glared.
I beg your pardon.
Nora Manger locked stares with Rachel.
I imagine in your business a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing. Well, trust me when I tell you that the same thing holds true for glaciology.
Nora's eyes shifted now, looking at each of the four people around her.
Let me clarify this for everyone once and for all. The frozen brine pockets that Miss Sexton has proposed do occur. They are what glaciologists call interstices. Interstices, however, form not as pockets of salt water, but rather as highly branched networks of brine ice whose tendrils are as wide as a human hair. That meteorite would have had to pass through one hell of a dense series of interstices to release enough salt water to create a 3% mixture in a pool that deep.
Ekstrom scowled.
So, is it possible or not?
Not on your life, Nora said flatly. Totally impossible. I would have hit pockets of brine ice in my core samples.
Core samples are drilled essentially in random spots, right? Rachel asked. Is there any chance the core's placements, simply by bad luck, could have missed a pocket of sea ice?
I drilled directly down over the meteorite. Then I drilled multiple cores only a few yards on either side. You can't get any closer.
Just asking.
The point is moot, Nora said. Brine interstices occur only in seasonal ice, ice that forms and melts every season. The Milne ice shaft is fast ice that forms in the mountains and holds fast until it migrates to the calving zone and falls into the sea. As convenient as frozen plankton would be for explaining this mysterious little phenomenon, I can guarantee there are no hidden networks of frozen plankton in this glacier.
The group fell silent again. Despite the stark rebuttal of the frozen plankton theory, Rachel's systematic analysis of the data refused to accept the rejection. Instinctively, Rachel knew that the presence of frozen plankton in the glacier beneath them was the simplest solution to the riddle. The law of parsimony, she thought. Her NRO instructors had driven it into her subconscious. When multiple explanations exist, the simplest is usually correct. Nora Manger obviously had a lot to lose if her ice core data was wrong, and Rachel wondered if maybe Nora had seen the plankton, realized she'd made a mistake in claiming the glacier was solid, and was now simply trying to cover her tracks.
All I know, Rachel said, is that I just briefed the entire White House staff and told them this meteorite was discovered in a pristine matrix of ice and had been sealed there, untouched by outside influence, since 1716, when it broke off of a famous meteorite called the Jungasol. This fact now appears to be in some question.
The NASA administrator was silent, his expression grave. Tallon cleared his throat.
I have to agree with Rachel. There was salt water and plankton in the pool. No matter what the explanation is, that shaft is obviously not a closed environment. We can't say it is.
Corky was looking uncomfortable.
Folks, not to sound like the astrophysicist here, but in my field, when we make mistakes, we're usually off by billions of years. Is this little plankton-saltwater mix-up really all that important? I mean, the perfection of the ice surrounding the meteorite in no way affects the meteorite itself, right? We still have the fossils. Nobody is questioning their authenticity. If it turns out we've made a mistake with the ice core data, nobody will really care. All they'll care about is that we found proof of life on another planet.
I'm sorry, Dr. Marlinson, Rachel said. As someone who analyzes data for a living, I have to disagree. Any tiny flaw in the data NASA presents tonight has the potential to cast doubt over the credibility of the entire discovery, including the authenticity of the fossils. Corky's jaw fell open.
What are you talking about? Those fossils are irrefutable.
I know that. You know that. But if the public catches wind that NASA knowingly presented ice core data that was in question, trust me, they will immediately start wondering what else NASA lied about. Nora stepped forward, eyes flashing.
My ice core data is not in question.
She turned to the administrator.
I can prove to you categorically that there is no brine ice trapped anywhere in this ice shelf.
The administrator eyed her a long moment.
How?
Nora outlined her plan. When she was done, Rachel had to admit the idea sounded like a reasonable one. The administrator didn't look so sure.
And the results will be definitive?
100% confirmation.
Nora assured him.
If there's one goddamn ounce of frozen salt water anywhere near that meteorite shaft, you will see it. Even a few droplets will light up on my gear like Times Square.
The administrator's brow furrowed beneath his military buzz cut.
There's not much time. The press conference is in a couple of hours.
I can be back in 20 minutes.
How far out on the glacier did you say you have to go?
Not far. 200 yards should do it.
Ekstrom nodded.
Are you certain it's safe?
I'll take flares, Nora replied. And Mike will go with me.
Tallon's head shot up.
I will.
You sure as hell will, Mike. We'll be tethered. I'd appreciate a strong set of arms out there if the wind whips up.
But she's right, the administrator said, turning to Tallon. If she goes, she can't go alone. I'd send some of my men with her, but frankly, I'd rather keep this plankton issue to ourselves until we figure out if it's a problem or not.
Tallon gave a reluctant nod.
I'd like to go too, Rachel said.
Nora spun like a cobra.
The hell you will!
Actually, the administrator said, as if an idea had just occurred to him, I think I'd feel safer if we used the standard quad tether configuration. If you go dual and Mike slips, you'll never hold him. 4 people are a lot safer than 2.
He paused, glancing at Corky.
That would mean either you or Dr. Ming.
Ekstrom glanced around the habosphere.
Where is Dr. Ming, anyway?
I haven't seen him in a while,
Tallon said. He might be catching a nap. Ekstrom turned to Corky.
Dr. Marlinson, I cannot require that you go out with them, and yet...
What the hell?
Corky said.
Seeing as everyone is getting along so well...
No,
Nora exclaimed.
4 people will slow us down. Mike and I are going alone.
You are not going alone.
The administrator's tone was final.
There's a reason tethers are built as quads, and we're going to do this as safely as possible. The last thing I need is an accident, a couple of hours before the biggest press conference in NASA's history.
Chapter 43. Gabrielle Ash felt a precarious uncertainty as she sat in the heavy air of Marjorie Tench's office. What could this woman possibly want with me? Behind the room's sole desk, Tench leaned back in her chair, her hard features seeming to radiate pleasure with Gabrielle's discomfort.
"Does the smoke bother you?"
Tench asked, tapping a fresh cigarette from her pack.
"No,"
Gabrielle lied. Tench was already lighting up anyway.
You and your candidate have taken quite an interest in NASA during this campaign.
True, Gabrielle snapped, making no effort to hide her anger. Thanks to some creative encouragement. I'd like an explanation.
Tench gave an innocent pout. You want to know why I've been sending you email fodder for your attack on NASA?
The information you sent me hurt your president.
In the short run, yes.
The ominous tone and tense voice made Gabrielle uneasy. What's that supposed to mean?
Relax, Gabrielle. My emails didn't change things much. Senator Sexton was NASA bashing long before I stepped in. I simply helped him clarify his message, solidify his position.
Solidify his position?
Exactly. Tent smiled, revealing stained teeth. Which I must say he did quite effectively this afternoon on CNN.
Gabrielle recalled the senator's reaction to Tench's fence-buster question.
Yes, I would act to abolish NASA.
Sexton had gotten himself cornered, but he'd played out of the rough with a strong drive.
It was the right move, wasn't it?
From Tench's contented look, Gabrielle sensed there was information missing.
Tench stood suddenly, her lanky frame dominating the cramped space. With the cigarette dangling from her lips, she walked over to a wall safe, removed a thick manila envelope, returned to the desk, and sat back down.
Gabrielle eyed the burgeoning envelope.
Tench smiled, cradling the envelope in her lap, like a poker player holding a royal flush. Her yellowed fingertips flicked at the corner, making an annoying, repetitive scratch, as if savoring the anticipation.
Gabrielle knew it was just her own guilty conscience, but her first fears were that the envelope contained some kind of proof of her sexual indiscretion with the senator.
Ridiculous, she thought.
The encounter had occurred after hours in Sexton's locked senatorial office. Not to mention, if the White House actually had any evidence, they would have gone public with it already.
They may be suspicious, Gabrielle thought, but they don't have proof.
Tench crushed out his cigarette.
Miss Ash, whether or not you are aware, you are caught in the middle of a battle that has been raging behind the scenes in Washington since 1996.
This opening gambit was not at all what Gabrielle expected.
I beg your pardon?
Tench lit another cigarette. Her spindly lips curled around it, and the tip glowed red.
What do you know about a bill called the Space Commercialization Promotions Act?
Gabrielle had never heard of it. She shrugged, lost.
Really? Tench said. That surprises me, considering your candidate's platform. The Space Commercialization Promotions Act was proposed back in 1996 by Senator Walker. The bill, in essence, cites the failure of NASA to do anything worthwhile since putting a man on the moon. It calls for the privatization of NASA by immediately selling off NASA assets to private aerospace companies and allowing the free market system to explore space more efficiently, thus relieving the burden NASA now places on taxpayers.
Gabrielle had heard NASA critics suggest privatization as a solution to NASA's woes, but she was not aware the idea had actually taken the form of an official bill.
This commercialization bill, Tench said, has been presented to Congress 4 times now. It is similar to bills that have successfully privatized government industries like uranium production. Congress has passed the space commercialization bill all 4 times it has seen it. Thankfully, the White House vetoed it on all occasions. Zachary Herney has had to veto it twice.
Your point?
My point is that this bill is one Senator Sexton will certainly support if he becomes president. I have reason to believe Sexton will have no qualms about selling off NASA assets to commercial bidders the first chance he gets. In short, your candidate would support privatization over having American tax dollars fund space exploration.
To my knowledge, the senator has never commented publicly about his stance on any Space Commercialization Promotions Act.
True, And yet, knowing his politics, I assume you would not be surprised if he supported it.
Free market systems tend to breed efficiency.
I'll take that as a yes. Tense stared. Sadly, privatizing NASA is an abominable idea. And there are countless reasons why every White House administration since the bill's inception has shot it down.
I've heard the arguments against privatizing space, Gabriel said, and I understand your concerns.
Do you? Tench leaned toward her. Which arguments have you heard?
Gabriel shifted uneasily.
Well, the standard academic fears, mostly. The most common being that if we privatize NASA, our current pursuit of scientific space knowledge would be quickly abandoned in favor of profitable ventures.
True. Space science would die in a heartbeat. Instead of spending money to study our universe, private space companies would strip mine asteroids, build tourist hotels in space, offer commercial satellite launch services. Why would private companies bother studying the origins of our universe when it would cost them billions and show no financial return?
They wouldn't, Gabriel countered. But certainly a national endowment for space science could be founded to fund academic missions.
We already have that system in place. It's called NASA.
Gabriel fell silent.
The abandonment of science in favor of profits is a side issue, Tent said. Hardly relevant compared to the utter chaos that would result by permitting the private sector to run free in space. We would have the Wild West all over again. We would see pioneers staking claims on the moon and on asteroids, and protecting those claims with force. I've heard petitions from companies who want to build neon billboards that blink advertisements in the nighttime sky. I've seen petitions from space hotels and tourist attractions whose proposed operations include ejecting their trash into the void of space and creating orbiting trash heaps. In fact, I just read a proposal yesterday from a company that wants to turn space into a mausoleum by launching the deceased into orbit. Can you imagine our telecommunications satellites colliding with dead bodies? Last week, I had a billionaire CEO in my office who was petitioning to launch a mission to a near-field asteroid, drag it closer to Earth, and mine it for precious minerals. I actually had to remind this guy that dragging asteroids into near-Earth orbit posed potential risks of global catastrophe. Miss Ash, I can assure you, if this bill passes, the throngs of entrepreneurs rushing into space will not be rocket scientists. They will be entrepreneurs with deep pockets and shallow minds.
Persuasive arguments, Gabriel said. And I'm sure the senator would weigh those issues carefully if he ever found himself in a position to vote on the bill. Might I ask what any of this has to do with me?
Tench's gaze narrowed over her cigarette. A lot of people stand to make a lot of money in space. And the political lobby is mounting to remove all restrictions and open the floodgates. The veto power of the office of the president is the only remaining barrier against privatization, against complete anarchy in space.
Then I commend Zach Herney for vetoing the bill.
My fear is that your candidate would not be so prudent if elected.
Again, I assume the senator would carefully weigh all the issues if we were ever in a position to pass judgment on the bill.
Tench didn't look entirely convinced. Do you know how much Senator Sexton spends on media advertising?
The question came out of left field.
Those figures are public domain.
More than $3 million a month.
Gabriel shrugged. If you say so. The figure was close.
That's a lot of money to spend.
He's got a lot of money to spend.
Yes, he planned well. Or rather, married well.
Tench paused to blow smoke.
It's sad about his wife, Catherine. Her death hit him hard.
A tragic sigh followed, clearly feigned.
Her death was not all that long ago, was it?
Come to your point or I'm leaving. Tench let out a lung-shaking cough and reached for the burgeoning manila folder. She pulled out a small stack of stapled papers and handed them to Gabrielle. Sexton's financial records. Gabrielle studied the documents in astonishment. The records went back several years. Although Gabrielle wasn't privy to the internal workings of Sexton's finances, she sensed this data was authentic. Banking accounts, credit card accounts, loans, stock assets, real estate assets, debts, capital gains and losses.
This is private data. Where did you get this?
My source is not your concern. But if you spend some time studying these figures, you will clearly see that Senator Sexton does not have the kind of money he is currently spending. After Catherine died, he squandered the vast majority of her legacy on bad investments, personal comforts, and buying himself what appears to be certain victory in the primaries. As of 6 months ago, your candidate was broke. Gabrielle sensed this had to be a bluff. If Sexton were broke, he sure wasn't acting it. He was buying advertising time in bigger and bigger blocks every week. Your candidate, Tench continued, is currently outspending the president 4-1, and he has no personal money. We get a lot of donations. Yes, some of them legal. Gabrielle's head shot up. I beg your pardon? Tench leaned across the desk, and Gabrielle could smell her nicotine breath. Gabrielle Ash, I'm going to ask you a question, and I suggest you think very carefully before you answer. It could affect whether you spend the next few years in jail or not. Are you aware that Senator Sexton is accepting enormous illegal campaign bribes from aerospace companies who have billions to gain from the privatization of NASA? Gabrielle stared. That's an absurd allegation. Are you saying you are unaware of this activity? I think I would know if the senator were accepting bribes of the magnitude you are suggesting. Tench smiled coldly. Gabrielle, I understand that Senator Sexton has shared a lot of himself with you. But I assure you there is plenty you do not know about the man. Gabrielle stood up.
This meeting is over.
On the contrary, Tench said, removing the remaining contents of the folder and spreading it on the desk. This meeting is just beginning. Chapter 44. Inside the Habosphere's staging room, Rachel Sexton felt like an astronaut as she slid into one of NASA's Mark IX microclimate survival suits. The black, one-piece, hooded jumpsuit resembled an inflatable scuba suit. Its two-ply memory foam fabric was fitted with hollow channels through which a dense gel was pumped to help the wearer regulate body temperature in both hot and cold environments. Now, as Rachel pulled the tight-fitting hood over her head, her eyes fell on the NASA administrator. He appeared as a silent sentinel at the door, clearly displeased with the necessity for this little mission. Nora Manger was muttering obscenities as she got everyone outfitted. "Here's an extra pudgy," she said, tossing Corky his suit. Tolland was already half into his. Once Rachel was fully zipped up, Nora found the stopcock on Rachel's side and connected her to an infusion tube that coiled out of a silver canister resembling a large scuba tank. "Inhale," Nora said, opening the valve. Rachel heard a hiss and felt gel being injected into the suit. The memory foam expanded, and the suit compressed around her, pressing down on her inner layer of clothing. The sensation reminded her of sticking her hand underwater while wearing a rubber glove. As the hood inflated around her head, it pressed in on her ears, making everyone sound muffled. "I'm in a cocoon." "Best thing about the Mark IX," Nora said, "is the padding. You can fall on your ass and not feel a thing." Rachel believed it. She felt like she was trapped inside a mattress. Nora handed Rachel a series of tools, an ice axe, tether snaps, and carabiners. which she affixed to the belt harnessed on Rachel's waist. "All this?" Rachel asked, eyeing the gear. "To go 200 yards?" Nora's eyes narrowed. "You want to come or not?"
Tallon gave Rachel a reassuring nod. "Nora's just being careful."
Corky connected to the infusion tank and inflated his suit, looking amused.
"I feel like I'm wearing a giant condom."
Nora gave a disgusted groan.
"Like you'd know, virgin boy."
Tallon sat down next to Rachel. He gave her a weak smile as she donned her heavy boots and crampons.
"You sure you want to come?"
His eyes had a protective concern that drew her in. Rachel hoped her confident nod belied her growing trepidation.
200 yards, not far at all.
"And you thought you could find excitement only on the high seas?"
Tallon chuckled, talking as he attached his own crampons.
"I've decided I like liquid water much better than this frozen stuff."
"I've never been a big fan of either," Rachel said. "I fell through the ice as a kid. Water's made me nervous ever since."
Tallon glanced over, his eyes sympathetic.
"Sorry to hear that. When this is over, you'll have to come out and visit me on the Goya. I'll change your mind about water, promise."
The invitation surprised her. The Goya was Tallon's research ship, well known both from its role in amazing seas as well as its reputation as one of the strangest-looking ships on the ocean. Although a visit to the Goya would be unnerving for Rachel, she knew it would be hard to pass up.
"She's anchored 12 miles off the coast of New Jersey at the moment," Tallon said, struggling with his crampon latches.
"Sounds like an unlikely spot."
"Not at all. The Atlantic seaboard is an incredible place. We were gearing up to shoot a new documentary when I was so rudely interrupted by the president."
Rachel laughed.
"Shooting a documentary on what?"
"Sferna Makarin and megaplumes."
Rachel frowned.
"Glad I asked."
Tallon finished attaching his crampons and looked up.
"Seriously, I'll be filming out there for a couple of weeks. Washington's not that far from the Jersey coast. Come out when you get back home. No reason to spend your life afraid of the water. My crew would roll out the red carpet for you."
Nora Manger's voice blared.
"Are we going outside, or should I get you two some candles and champagne?"
Chapter 45. Gabrielle Ash had no idea what to make of the documents now spread out before her on Marjorie Tench's desk. The pile included photocopied letters, faxes, transcripts of phone conversations, and they all seemed to support the allegation that Senator Sexton was in covert dialogue with private space companies. Tench pushed a couple of grainy black-and-white photographs toward Gabrielle.
"I assume this is news to you."
Gabrielle looked at the photos. The first candid shot showed Senator Sexton getting out of a taxi in some kind of underground garage.
"Sexton never takes taxis."
Gabrielle looked at the second shot, a telephoto of Sexton climbing into a parked white minivan. An old man appeared to be in the van waiting for him.
"Who is that?"
Gabrielle said, suspicious the photos might be faked.
"A big shot from the SFF.
Gabrielle was doubtful.
"The Space Frontier Foundation?"
The SFF was like a union for private space companies. It represented aerospace contractors, entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, any private entity that wanted to go into space. They tended to be critical of NASA, arguing that the U.S. space program employed unfair business practices to prevent private companies from launching missions into space.
"The SFF," Tench said, "now represents over 100 major corporations, some very wealthy enterprises who are waiting eagerly for the Space Commercialization Promotions Act to be ratified."
Gabrielle considered it. For obvious reasons, the SFF was a vocal supporter of Sexton's campaign, although the senator had been careful not to get too close to them because of their controversial lobbying tactics. Recently, the SFF had published an explosive rant charging that NASA was in fact an illegal monopoly, whose ability to operate at a loss and still stay in business represented unfair competition to private firms. According to the SFF, Whenever AT&T needed a telecom satellite launched, several private space companies offered to do the job at a reasonable $50 million. Unfortunately, NASA always stepped in and offered to launch AT&T's satellites for a mere $25 million, even though it cost NASA five times that to do the job. Operating at a loss is one way NASA keeps its grip on space, the SFF lawyers accused, and taxpayers pick up the tab.
This photo reveals, Tent said, that your candidate is holding secret meetings with an organization that represents private space enterprises.
Tench motioned to several other documents on the table.
We also have internal SFF memos calling for huge sums of money to be collected from SFF member companies in amounts commensurate with their net worth and transferred to accounts controlled by Senator Sexton. In effect, these private space agencies are anteing up to put Sexton in office. I can only assume he has agreed to pass the commercialization bill and privatize NASA if elected.
Gabrielle looked at the pile of papers, unconvinced. Do you expect me to believe that the White House has evidence that its opponent is engaged in profoundly illegal campaign finance, and yet, for some reason, you're keeping it secret?
What would you believe?
Gabrielle glared. Frankly, considering your skills for manipulation, a more logical solution seems that you are plying me somehow with phony documents and photos produced by some enterprising White House staffer and his desktop publishing computer.
Possible, I admit, but not true.
No? Then how did you get all these internal documents from corporations? The resources required to steal all of this evidence from so many companies certainly exceeds the grasp of the White House.
You're right. This information arrived here as an unsolicited gift.
Gabrielle was now lost.
Oh, yes, Tent said. We get a lot of it. The president has many powerful political allies who would like to see him stay in office. Remember, your candidate is suggesting cuts all over the place. A lot of them right here in Washington. Senator Sexton certainly has no qualms about citing the FBI's bloated budget as an example of government overspending. He's taken some pot shots at the IRS, too. Maybe someone at the Bureau or at the service got a little annoyed.
Gabrielle got the implication. People at the FBI and IRS would have ways of getting this kind of information. They might then send it to the White House as an unsolicited favor to help the president's election. But what Gabrielle could not make herself believe was that Senator Sexton would ever be engaged in illegal campaign funding. If this data is accurate, Gabrielle challenged, which I strongly doubt it is, why haven't you gone public?
Why do you think?
Because it was gathered illegally.
How we got it makes no difference.
Of course it makes a difference. It's inadmissible in a hearing.
What hearing? We'd simply leak this to a newspaper, and they'd run it as a credible source story with photos and documentation. Sexton would be guilty until proven innocent. His vocal anti-NASA stance would be virtual proof that he is taking bribes.
Gabrielle knew it was true.
Fine, she challenged. Then why haven't you leaked the information?
Because it's a negative. The president promised not to go negative in the campaign, and he wants to stick to that promise as long as he can.
Yeah, right. You're telling me the president is so upstanding that he refuses to go public with this because people might consider it a negative?
It's a negative for the country. It implicates dozens of private companies, many of which are made up of honest people. It besmirches the office of the U.S. Senate and is bad for the country's morale. Dishonest politicians hurt all politicians. Americans need to trust their leaders. This would be an ugly investigation, and would most likely send a U.S. senator and numerous prominent aerospace executives to jail.
Although Tench's logic did make sense, Gabrielle still doubted the allegations.
What does any of this have to do with me?
Simply put, Ms. Ash, if we release these documents, your candidate will be indicted for illegal campaign financing, lose his Senate seat, and most likely do prison time.
Tench paused.
Unless
Gabrielle saw a snake-like glint in the senior advisor's eyes.
Unless what?
Tench took a long drag on her cigarette.
Unless you decide to help us avoid all that.
A murky silence settled over the room. Tench coughed roughly.
Gabrielle, listen.